As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. Alongside me today are Tom Roddy, Tony Cascarino and Alison Rudd. Let's get straight into it. The big one at the Emirates. Another frenzied, emotional, wild game at the Emirates on Sunday against Manchester United. Alison, you were there. Declan Rice was the hero. Rice, baby.
Yeah,
belting out at the end. What did you make of that and the game?
Well, I'm still a little shell-shocked from it all. It's my first game at the Emirates this season, and they now sing an anthem before kickoff. It's so artificial.
Can you sing it for us?
Alex, it's tuneless, so I can't. It's not even catchy. And it's a sort of mournful song that speaks of, I don't know, fishermen lost at sea or something. That's how it feels. And it's the sort of song that you should only sing if you know that your great-grandfather sang it as well when he supported the Arsenal. And so it's just come from nowhere. And yet, but I have to admit, everybody sang it. And it set the scene for a quite remarkable, febrile atmosphere. My ears didn't literally bleed, but I did check to see if they were, because the cacophony, I haven't come across that at the Emirates ever.
You've been quite scathing of the Emirates, like, in recent seasons.
So
it has changed, hasn't it?
And this is why they've done it, because you're not going to win the title unless you've got fans that back you when things go wrong. You need to know that they're there come what may. And it worked, because Arsenal didn't play particularly well. Part of the reason they got over the line was this incredible, raucous atmosphere cheering them on, which must have made them feel like they were playing well, even when they weren't. So, you know, and the Rice, baby at the end, you'd think, wow, you know, Declan Rice must have had one of those 10 out of 10 games. Well, he didn't. I mean, he scored a lucky goal and probably was influential for about half an hour. I mean, he wasn't like he dominated the game. So it's a difficult match to sort of get your senses and your brain working in tandem together. They were overall, Arsenal were the better team, but I did think they were very vulnerable to counter-attacks. Christian Eriksen was the only grown-up on the pitch for Manchester United, but his distribution was fantastic, and he set up the opening goal with a lovely sweeping pass. And he got the ball because Kai Havertz lost possession, and I found myself trying not to, but I couldn't help but watch Kai Havertz, because it was sort of mesmeric how awful it is for him there.
That fresh air shot.
I know. I'd set the tone for him. And I mean, if you were doing a script, you wouldn't write that, because it'd be a bit obvious. You've had your manager telling the fans, please be patient with him, show him some, you know, love. This is going to work out. And so you sort of sense that the fans were in a generous mood. And there weren't too much groaning when he missed that air shot, but he was there in the air, this sense of, really? Really? Why are we supposed to give this player love? He's just not on the same wavelength as everybody else. So Arsenal improved when he went off, actually. There was a sense of that sort of tentativeness in the attack where the players... I mean, for example, Havertz would make the same run as someone else, often Martinelli. I kept thinking, why are you doing that? You know, you've got to show something different. He looked inhibited and worried. And when he went off, they looked more fluid as an attack and freer as an attack. But whilst it was a thrilling, thrilling match, I think overall the quality on show, certainly from Arsenal's point of view, that they're not saying to City, oh, look out, we are here to do it this time around. Tony made a similar point that I made as well in the paper, which is Arsenal have to calm down a little bit. They're hurtling. To me, they're hurtling towards October the 8th, which is when they meet Manchester City. It's as though Arteta wants to get the season this part of the season out of the way as quickly as possible. And then the big game is the really big game is against City. And then when he wins that, he will show that he can win the title. But I don't think it's sustainable to play at this sort of level of frenetic pace. And they're going to come unstuck. They almost came unstuck against a not very good Manchester United team.
It's a great way to win. But as Alison's saying, does that feel a sustainable way to get through a Premier League campaign if you want to challenge for the title?
Do we know what the XG was? Because this is the hipster podcast on Monday, isn't it?
You must know. You brought it up.
Right. I've been waiting 2 weeks to correct this. Scandalously
take that, Martin Samuel.
Tom Clark. Yeah, funnily enough, I was looking at it more from a Man United perspective. And again, they don't win on the road to one of their big rivals. But even though Ten Hag afterwards sounded like a really desperate man in his comments about the VAR line being at the wrong angle.
Strange, wasn't it?
And the penalty shouts, I didn't really agree with him on any of them. And yet I was actually kind of encouraged at the end by United, and the reason for that was Rasmus Højlund, because a couple of weeks ago I raised the point about the expectation and pressure that was going to be on him when he came into the team because of them having such a poor start. But actually I thought he responded to it, and they kind of, it was like they fell into place when he came on. They it was a more natural fit, more of a balance, like a Rubik's cube slowly getting to that moment where it's full. They're definitely not at that stage yet, but it was getting a little bit closer to it, where they just, Rashford looked so much more comfortable out on the left, and Ali wrote about Højlund's relationship with Christian Eriksen, and it was just the way it wasn't the longest cameo, but in that environment it was a real sort of baptism of fire and welcome to English football, and he responded to it.
And he's got
hugely.
A back issue. So the big question was whether he'd come on and be tentative in any way because he's had this back issue, which had delayed his debut. But he was incredibly boisterous and physical and keen to get stuck in. This wasn't a player worrying about his fitness. So that was, from a United point of view, very encouraging indeed, just how physical he was.
Tony, it's still fine margins though, isn't it? I mean, yeah. As we said, there wasn't much quality in the game for really the first hour, for most of the game. And then Garnacho scored an offside goal disallowed by VAR. And you know, you could have almost been talking about a Manchester United kind of dogged, compact performance, away win. And now we're talking about, you know, the focus is on, you know, are they really showing enough in terms of attacking patterns of play, anything to actually go and win a game? But it was quite, you know, the margins were quite fine in this game.
Yeah, I get that. Look, Arsenal started the game really brightly. And United were trying to beat the world record in passing from out the back, from the goal. I mean, Onana is just, it feels like, I look at Onana and I get thinking, do you want the trickiest ball out the back to play and then say, look, he can play it the outside of his boot. He's number one best footballing goalkeeper. Which he loves, he seems to embrace that, which is fine. But I'm looking and thinking, some of the best players in the world might not attempt that pass out the back. And he will. So I sort of think that it's interesting that if you add dynamism to a team, and Garnacho and obviously Højlund, who obviously I think he gives that, you know, you're talking straight away about a different dynamic in the forward line as soon as the two subs came on. And look, there are fine lines. I mean, I thought in normal time, I thought he's on. Then I saw the angle and I still think he's still on. And then it comes over, he's a red line and he's off. Okay. They're fine margins, which Declan Rice talked about. I think the bigger picture for United is they carry a few. They carry Martial. They carry him. He doesn't do enough. We've talked about Rasmus Højlund coming on. What did he do? He just made it hard for defenders. Martial doesn't make it hard for anybody. He makes it hard for his own teammates. You know, there's got to be more from him. You know, this lad come over as a kid from Monaco. Has been, how long has he been there now? 7 years at Man United? 6, 7 years? I just don't get it. I don't get it.
Yeah, I agree with Cass on that. And watching the game yesterday, I know there's injuries involved there as well, but you see the game finished with Harry Maguire and Johnny Evans at the back. Mm. I know Martial was off the pitch by then, but Paul Hurst was writing at the beginning of summer about the target for United was obviously to improve the squad, but also get rid of the deadwood. And Martial has definitely been that for a long time. He's been given countless opportunities, and they finished the game with a 35-year-old Johnny Evans and Harry Maguire at centre-back.
But Martial's interesting because I called it the least surprising substitution you'll ever see, that Højlund would come on for Martial. I mean, everyone in the universe knew that was going to be the substitution. And I'm sure Martial knew that was going to be the situation. But did he take that as a incentive to put in one of his better performances, or
no?
You know, really throw his weight around or show his pace? Or, well, he didn't. He accepted. This is the end of my United career.
One manager said to me at my very start of my career at Gillingham, Keith Peacock, and he said to me, "If you're having a bad game, have a stinker." I used to think, "What does that mean?" Really, when he first said it to me, it means never stop wanting the ball. Never stop trying. Get on the ball. Face up for your players. Make sure you're still available for them. And then within that, you could have a stinker because you're having a bad day. And by the way, I did have some real stinkers in my career. But I always had it in my head of Keith Peacock, my manager, telling me never, ever hide in a game. Now, we could be a bit unfair on Martial in some way where... Is he hiding? I just feel there has to be more in the way your demeanour on the pitch, the way that centre-halves look and think, I'm up against Martial today.
Yeah.
He ain't going to run. He ain't going to chase me. He ain't going to hassle me. He ain't going to make my life difficult. Yeah. You know, that's the opposition, because that's how I would see him. And I think there's lots of complicated things at United. It's very complex how this team is been put together. It just doesn't look... Even Casemiro looks a way poorer player than when he first turned up at Man United. You know, now looks like a player that's left isolated at times because it's not quite right in the middle of the park. You know, so they've got a number of issues to deal with. And actually a better team than last year. And I think a lot is, as Tom wrote about a couple of weeks ago, you know, that Højlund's coming in and he has to be devastating. But it might, in some ways, they might, with Garnacho and Højlund and Rashford... In that three, because also I'm a bit suspicious of Peter Beardsley, because he reminds me so much of Peter Beardsley. I feel like I'm being unfair to Peter Beardsley of everybody I mentioned, but he used to twist and turn and turn and turn.
Anthony
does it 10 times worse, you know, than Peter Beardsley did it. But he was effective as well, Peter Beardsley. But
it looks like they didn't want to give him the ball.
Well, why would you? You know you're not getting it back. If I'm the centre forward, and this is where I probably could defend Martial. If I'm the centre forward, I'd go once. No, not coming. Again, no, not coming in. What's the point of going? Just like have my hands up in the air. Is that, you know, I think he would frustrate his fellow, which, you know, I think Wan-Bissaka in front of him as well sometimes thinks, I'll give it to him, and is it worth overlapping him? Because he's just going to cut inside or do a trick. And I think he's a dangerous player for other players because he gives them problems instead of solutions to, you know, what they're trying to achieve.
Just finally on this, we've already mentioned Ten Hag's kind of strange, not an outburst, but, you know, he's calling everything under the sun, blaming officials, technology. He even sort of referenced Jadon Sancho, who wasn't there, said that it was because of his performance in training during the week, and Sancho has come out on social media afterwards and sort of disagreed pretty firmly with that statement. What do we make of that whole episode? Is it wise of Sancho to have done that? Was it unfair of Ten Hag to kind of publicly call him out like that?
It's hard to say whether it was unfair of him to call him out like that without being there. But I do wonder whether Ten Hag would have said the same thing had they won the game. He was clearly very emotional after the game. And then Sancho's gone boom and hit the nuclear button by putting that post out, because I think that puts him back at least three steps, if not. You, Rio Ferdinand, suggesting he could end up going to Saudi if he wants to play this season, because he just won't, because he won't play, he won't be involved after making comments like that. And it was clear, you know, this was very pointed, saying I've been made a scapegoat. And actually, looking back on the timeline, I think Ten Hag's handling of Sancho has been very progressive, really. Where he left him out of that winter, if I remember rightly, he left him out of the winter training camp and spoke about the physical and mental aspects that he needed to work on. He said about the need to be patient. And back right at the very beginning when he was signed for United for £73 million, third most expensive Englishman of all time at that in that summer. And I remember the reports later on that a lot of people were unimpressed by his performances in training, in that first training session. His levels weren't there at that stage. So what the way I read Ten Hag's comments yesterday is Sancho comes back into the fold. He is now part of it. He had a decent pre-season playing as a false nine. And now he's almost trying the stick instead of the arm around the shoulder just to kind of encourage him and get him to the right level, because he's obviously not at the moment.
What do we think? Wise to use social media as a platform to publicly disagree with your manager?
Gregor, think of the managers you've played under. How would they react to it? You know, come on. You have a word quietly. Now, we don't know the dynamics at the training ground and what's been said behind closed doors. We don't know that. But certainly there's a breakdown in the relationship. And Tom's absolutely spot on talking about, you know, how kind and understanding he was as a manager and a coach. Showed that he felt like he was trying to find a solution to get a better player out of him. But you also got to remember, if you want to broaden it a bit and go, well, Gareth Southgate left him out of England. Well, you could say it's on performances, but he also said about turning up late. He's got to be really careful, because when you play poorly or you're playing below your standard, it's expected of you. If the fans get angry and frustrated with you, certainly your players and your colleagues alongside you, like Tom said, in training, they were surprised that he wasn't up to it. He wasn't up to the speed of the game. And what has he played? Over 70 games for, on and off, I know he's substitute, over 70 games for Man United at the moment? No, he's not like he's not had a chance. You know, Kai Havertz is getting, and rightly so, he's not played well. You know, kind of under scrutiny. Sancho's played, what? We're talking four games for Arsenal. Five games, Kai Havertz. Sancho's had 70 games to impress, and he hasn't impressed at all. I've watched him numerous times and come off, there's got to be more from you. You know, you've got to make a right back think about defending, or you're trying to get in deep areas, get to the byline. He's a guy that was meant to be blessed with pace. I've never seen him get to the byline. You know, to pull things back. And, you know, Martinelli, one of his big strengths, and you see it enough yesterday, Wan-Bissaka's quick and he's also good at one-on-ones. But Martinelli was trying to get to the byline against him. He never stopped. Sometimes he didn't do it. But you know what? He won a number of corners with an outstretched leg by Wan-Bissaka. And Sancho is not playing well. Going to social media is not an answer. You privately have a conversation. And also, if you're going to be brave enough to say, I'm a scapegoat, well, say your reasons for why you're a scapegoat. If you're prepared to just throw that out there, I think you might as well go the whole hog.
Should we move on to Stamford Bridge, Tom? Interesting one. Headline in your piece in the game today was, why spend £1 billion and not buy a finisher? This is after Chelsea's 1-0 defeat to Nottingham Forest at home.
Yeah, well, it was the takeaway I had from leaving the ground on Saturday was, because they created chances, Chelsea, not loads and loads, but and never really. I was rewatching the highlights back this morning, and thought it made it look like they were getting closer and closer. The atmosphere in the ground wasn't like that. It never felt like they were going to score at all. And my reflection was that the Cole Palmer transfer tipped spending into over £1 billion for Todd Boehly and Clear Lake Capital over 18 months. So many players coming in and they just haven't got a goal scorer in there. And I don't actually mean that I mean it for games like this, where I think this year you could see Raheem Sterling getting a lot of goals. He started the season well. He's obviously built a good relationship with Pochettino. Nicholas Jackson is, I really like him. I warmed to him immediately in that he's just such a hard-working player. He's got really good quality on the ball. I think in the opposite way to Martial, he'd be a nightmare to play against. Really hard to
play.
You see,
the fans have warmed him as well,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely.
Despite his kind of struggles in front of goal.
Yeah, so there's, and that's the, that was the sort of key, was that big open goal miss that he has late on. And I think they'll get, they'll have a group of players who score quite a few goals this season, but there in, there isn't a number nine in there who is going to, on days when you're not creating enough chances, will get you out of jail by taking the one opportunity they have. Cass said about, you know, having a, ending up, if you're having a bad day, of a stinker. There's strikers who have stinkers but come out actually quite positively because they've taken their one chance, done nothing well. Even Aubameyang's not a great example, but he actually scored a few goals at Chelsea last season when he had a terrible game, but he'd take his one opportunity. And it wasn't, that was never going to work long term, but just am surprised that they didn't bring someone in of that quality. And it's not that they haven't been, that they've had a plan and gone with that and not changed from it, because you've had points this summer where Tyler Adams has been having a medical, he's been on the verge of joining the club, and then Liverpool come in with the bid for Caicedo and they go, no, we need to get him, so we're going, we need that money in order to get Caicedo. They've been quite dynamic this summer, so I just don't see why there couldn't have been efforts to go for a goal scorer. And I know that's not easy to do. I know they are the most expensive players on the planet usually.
It's also something we've been seeing. Who's injured as well, and that was unlucky, wasn't it?
Yeah,
but this is not something new either. We've been having the same kind of discussion for quite a while. What, just quickly, what was their play like, their build-up play until that point? I think you wrote they had 22 chances in the game, and although only hit two on target, but were there any promising signs in Pochettino's kind of...
I thought this was maybe a step back. So they've had two defeats so far. The West Ham one seemed highly negative, but actually I thought it was more positive than this, because they played really well in that game, and I think if Enzo Fernandez scores the penalty just before half time, they win it comfortably. This wasn't quite so much, because they never looked like scoring, and that feeds into a little bit why I wrote the piece about the striker missing, because the build-up was okay, but they couldn't break down that type of defence. That was the problem. It was a really, really disciplined defensive performance by Nottingham Forest, and the story of, you know, Joe Worrall and what he went through with the bereavement in his family. He was excellent in that game and kind of represented what they were doing and the way they approached it. And Forest had a game plan that just worked to perfection. And the other problem for Chelsea is that they've played five games so far this season. They've kept one clean sheet, and that was against Luton. So they're open at the back, as well as they're not clinical enough in attack.
But you were on you went to see Chelsea on their pre-season mm-hmm. tour in America, didn't you? And I think they mainly played four at the back, and they look quite attacking. Why now that real stuff started, are they playing what looks like a quite conservative formation with three at the back, and they don't look like they're ever going to flood forward?
Yeah, well, partially, and I think you're right, Ali, this is probably one of the problems, but it was at the West Ham game, and Pochettino said, I played four at the back, it wasn't a three. It looks like a three, but Colwell is actually the left back. But I agree with you, Ali. I still think Colwell wants to play inside, so actually more often than not it's actually more like a back three. But Ben Chilwell is essentially a winger. So to another point, if you are Mikaela Mudryk or Ian Mattson, who had an excellent pre-season, but not many people are talking about him.
They tried to push Palmer out the door, though, didn't they?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So Cole Palmer was obviously new and had a pretty positive debut off the bench, or Noni Madueke, and you're thinking they've signed all of these forwardy, wingery players, and the left back is playing winger.
Yeah.
You might be slightly confused. I mean, I still think it'll come good for Chelsea, and I do. Pochettino said after the window that will settle us, which I agree with, and speaks to the conversation that's been going on for a long time now and will keep going on about the transfer deadline closing before the season starts rather than after it starts. But I also heard a change in his messaging. When he was unveiled, he said they need to hit the ground running. There are no excuses. And this weekend he said, oh, it's a process, and sometimes it takes time. And I totally understand why he's saying that and what he's saying. But it was interesting to notice that little shift in the way he speaks.
So who impressed you for Nottingham Forest? Anthony Elanga scored what was the winning goal.
Little
kind of, certainly in the highlights, some little flourishes on the byline as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of tricks.
Against Mudrick.
Looks like he could be a...
He's really calm. He's calm in the final third. But, I mean, there was... Steve Cooper was so upset to have lost Brennan Johnson. But a Wanyi would be the one that you would want to lose. Because we're talking about teams and managers buying so many of these forward players now, and the lack of number nine options. He's brilliant, Awoniyi.
Would you argue, Tom, that Awoniyi is exactly what Chelsea need in some bizarre way?
Possibly.
It's funny, we would not have been saying that at the start of last season.
No. And look,
I think he's on a good run, but.
Well, look, if you think about Forest and you think about Chelsea, both of them have been incredibly aggressive and they've gone after loads of players. Last summer was incredible. I was like, it's mind-boggling what Forest are doing. And Chelsea have done it even at a more extreme level with the amount of finance they've spent. But if you look at the two structures of the team, one looks way more settled than Chelsea. You know, Forest look way more... Steve Cooper's managed to somehow formulate a team.
Despite everything, yeah.
And in spite of everything, and you're right, Brennan Johnson's a big loss for them, but there's still a structure of a side there that looks like they can affect and you know, let's get right, you know, the game at Old Trafford. And they were unfortunate to get beyond the end of that result. You know, they've done enough in that game to get something.
There are parallels between these two clubs as well, because I think Forest brought it to 40 signings since they were promoted.
It's mad.
This summer. And the two players who, you know, probably stood out and still stand out are Worrall and Yates, two homegrown players. Johnson had to really be sold because of all the excess. Because as we've said so many times now, there's this new term, pure profit, because he is a homegrown player. And Chelsea have had to do the same. They've tried to do, again, as I said, Ian Matson, they tried to usher out the door to Burnley.
They've chosen to do the same, not had to.
They have chosen, you're right, I think Forest, I'm not sure you could say they've chosen to do this, but they had to do it. But it's sad that, I mean, because there's something about, you know, Worrall and Yates, who still are like the heartbeat of this team, despite all the change around them.
Yeah.
And Chelsea did have that, and they're kind of losing that.
But you're right about the parallels between Forest and Chelsea, because actually the first couple of weeks of the season, I've had a look at Tottenham and thought of Chelsea because of the speed at which Ange Postecoglou has totally transformed the way they play. There hasn't been a process there. That happened pretty much overnight. I can't think of many more conservative teams than Tottenham last season, and now they're an absolute joy to watch. So he's done that absolutely immediately. But the difference is that Postecoglou was one of the only people to come in at Spurs that it is settled, pretty settled, behind the scenes. Whereas Chelsea and Forest are the clubs where all around there is change. So it all has to find it all has to settle down, really. It's not just the playing department.
Okay, we'll talk Spurs next. But if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, a five-star showing for Tottenham Hotspur at Burnley. Harry Hu was the headline in Charlotte Dunker's piece in the game today. Hat-trick for Son, one of three hat-tricks this weekend, as well as Evan Ferguson at Brighton and Erling Haaland at Manchester City. But as Charlotte writes today, Tony, the way that Tottenham are managing to kind of spread the goals and the kind of creative burden as well, because as we know, Harry Kane contributes so much in terms of dropping deep and creating for Spurs as well, and now the kind of front foot free flowing attacking football has been a bit of a joy to behold so far.
Yeah, and I used a line at the weekend on the radio that I sort of brought up at the moment on a moment, was that James Snow Madison, because he's settled so quickly. Call him Snow. He's literally, I mean, I can't remember a player. You have to be careful when you say that, the way you say it. But do you know when you see a player come to a football club and you think, he's playing like he's been there 3 years? I'm watching him play and seeing a player just... And where we've got it wrong, and I thought about this at the start of the season, because I'm looking at Richarlison, and we've talked about Richarlison about playing that role. But Son's played that on-the-shoulder role all the time in his career, when he's been at his best, and Harry Kane's dropped in and he suddenly sees a pass and he threads it through to Son, he's on his bike, he gets loads of one-on-ones, yeah? And, well, what's exactly James Maddison's best assets is he sees that early pass, that ball, that if someone makes a run, I'm giving it to you. So you make it. And Richarlison wasn't doing that. And Son has come, you know, his relationship has looked really telepathic already with Maddison. And Madison's had a massive impact to the way I think Spurs will concede a load of goals. I just don't see a defensive side to them yet. Does it really matter when they get five? Well, no, not at the moment. But along the way, there's going to be a much tougher or more sides that are more stingy. They don't give you a thing. And I think that's where the complicated times will come for Spurs. But there is a new dynamic. The fourth goal, which Son got, they were 3-1 up. And it's five people in the 18-yard box. Five bodies in the 18-yard box. To me, that is everything about getting goal, trying to get goals. Trying to, you know, we would have looked at last year and Conte was 2-1 up, 3-1 up. They're not getting a third and they're not going to fourth. You know, generally that wasn't their style. So I now look at it and think, even if they're winning a game, and this is where Man City were brilliant, this is where Liverpool were brilliant. Manchester United used to do it as well. They throw the kitchen sink at you when you were 2-1, you know, they're winning 2-1, 3-1. They're still coming after you for a fourth and fifth. That will be the exciting thing for Spurs fans, because this Spurs team will keep coming at you.
But it's not that revelatory, really, no. Because whenever Kane was injured, Son would play as the main striker, and he always delivered. Mm. So if I was taking over at Spurs, I would have looked back at those... And knowing that Harry Kane was probably going to leave, I'd have looked back at what Spurs did when Harry Kane was out injured and thought, it's okay. It's not a big deal. Son is an incredible player who was hampered by injury last season, and that's not his fault. And probably what is his fault is he kept going when he probably should have had some rest, actually. I think he played games he shouldn't have played. But to have him in your team is such an asset. And as you say, he's such an intelligent player. If someone else intelligent on the pitch... you've got it. Yeah. They'll be phenomenal.
So what's changed then is what's going on behind them, actually, because I think the fifth goal that probably epitomised it was when Pedro Porro stepped forward into midfield to receive the ball, where most fullbacks would pull out wide.
Yeah.
Opened up, whipped a great ball in behind for Son to run onto. And that's the kind of, between him and Udogie on the left coming inside, that seems to be the biggest change for Spurs, certainly in the build-up play. As you say, there's so many options going forward. If Brendan Johnson to come in, Manor Solomon as well had a really impressive, he linked really well with Son.
Bentancur's two assists. Had a long injury, yeah. And he's a really good footballer. Sees things, smart player. They're, you know, the signs are good. I just think they will concede a number of goals, but that's
Ange Ball.
Yeah, going to concede loads.
So do we think this is sustainable for Spurs? You're saying they're going to concede goals. You won't always score five.
No.
Do we think
how far sustainable than the current attitude at Arsenal? To be honest, because it feels more. It just feels more inherent and like the plan. And for as long as they've got Postecoglou, this is what they're going to do. There's no plan B. That's what they're going to be. And it works because that's supposedly part of the Tottenham DNA to be like that anyway. Mm. So everyone's buying into it. As I was talking about, my brain was frazzled by the change in attitude at the Emirates. The Spurs fans have very quickly decided that Ange is the messiah. They love it. So if there's no negative reaction to when they do concede and get a blip, they'll have that sense of freedom that this is the Spurs way. We've had some bad years where we forgot the Spurs way, and now we're going to do it. And you need a manager that's who he is and has no fear about it. I sort of get the impression from Postecoglou that if anyone was to criticise his defensive approach, i.e. at the club, he'd just walk out. So you know what you're getting. This is what I do. That overwhelming sense of this is... Yeah. Everyone's bought into it.
Clarity, yeah.
It's fine. It will work.
There is a sense of when managers have this style of the way they want to play, well, this is how we go, and if the opposition know what's coming, don't disappoint them. Mm. You know, Man United did it for years. Everyone knew that Man United played two wingers. They'd literally get round the back of you. They'd play two centre-forwards. Things would be coming in from everywhere with high-quality players. You try and stop it. Now, Fergie had years of creating teams that were nearly, I'd say not impossible to play against, but, you know, really tough to play against because they can match you physically and also give you problems. You know, what has Pep done? Pep's got a style that this ain't changing. You know, Klopp's introduced a style that he don't want to change. You know, Klopp's not going to suddenly have a counter-attacking team. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't want to be the manager. If you're going to do that, go and employ somebody else. You know, and I think that's where I think that Postecoglou is won over already because the fans are seeing something they haven't seen for about 3 or 4 years or maybe even longer.
Tom, you wrote about James Maddison in the paper this weekend, a profile piece about his kind of his journey and a bit of an insight about his personality too, which undoubtedly you see on the pitch. So what did you learn in this when you wrote this piece?
I think the part of the purpose of doing this piece was because we immediately saw his impact on the pitch. And as Cass touched on, it was just instant. He fit into that team like he's been there for years and years and years. And I kind of wanted to look into how he's impacted the club as a off the pitch and why he has been so quick to settle there. And we spoke to loads of different people around him, and people at Spurs had this idea that because obviously they haven't known him that long, but they had this idea that because he's a father, he's very quickly matured, and that might be partially because Stuart Webber in the piece told me that 5 years ago he was the one saying to Spurs, you've got to sign this kid because if you don't, the next time he does become available, a club like Spurs won't be able to afford him. That was the trajectory he was on, and of course Spurs turned him down at that time because of his personality. They said, we like him, but because of his personality. And of course it has very quickly, because of the interviews he does, and one of the stories I heard was that a broadcaster, whether it was this season or last season, they were speaking to the club and they had an interview with Maddison before the game. They wanted him, as it is in like a few days before the game, they wanted him for the pre-match interview and wanted him for the post-match interview. And that's
he has made a big impression, hasn't he, in massive. These interviews.
And it's all that's it. It's because of his interviews, they're so refreshingly original that he has very quickly changed the image and perspective on him because years ago, 5 years ago, he had this kind of party boy image and an arrogant, cocky player. And there's an element to that. People spoke about him being quite cocky and arrogant. The senior players in teams, Stephen Pressley at Coventry said that the senior players said he is a bit arrogant, but that is part of him as a player. That's what makes him great. And there is a fine line between it. And I think
it still manages to be endearing too. It's
absolutely.
Not like, you know, cocky so and so.
No, and right now he falls on the right side of that line. And there were just some really I really enjoyed doing this piece because there were just some fantastic stories from his school days where he would get this. There was this lost property box called the Lucky Dip, and him and his mates would go and get like the most ridiculous outfits, tiny little shorts, massive baggy shirts, and they'd sing the national anthem on days when England were playing, and just nice little images. It was good fun to do.
Do you know a little bit on the personality of Maddison is that one thing I straight away I thought I love this. Not one mention of him not signing to Tottenham because Harry Kane was leaving. Now, he would have had an idea, Kane was, like we all did. But he's not gone, I'm not sure if I want to go to Spurs, Kane's leaving. It's been actually, I'll take that mantle up.
Yeah.
But he did,
it feels like that to me.
But he had surprisingly few suitors, it seems. I mean, I know Newcastle, we spoke about this a few weeks ago, but for the price, for what's it going to be, 40, maybe rising to 45 million? I know it's a lot of money. And Postecoglou laughed the last weekend when it was put to him that he was going to be a bargain.
Yeah.
But he is.
Do you think that's because of last season? Because he didn't have, with Leicester and I think he had a few injuries last year, but he didn't have the best season last year, did he?
So it's almost like he still scored he still posted great numbers. I think it was 11 goals, maybe 9 assists, something like that.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, that surprises you in a team that was relegated. His numbers are in the top five since he's been in the Premier League of all players, and the rest of the players are all playing for better teams than him.
Yeah.
So it's, to me, it was mind-boggling.
Is relegation a bit of a problem for prices for clubs where, later when Hull got relegated and Andy Robertson went to Liverpool for what, 12, 8 million was it?
Eight million.
£8 million. I don't know if it lowers your price tag because you're associated with being in a relegated team, so you can't be that good.
Well, there should be more people in for them then.
Yeah, but and whereas, Brighton have been brilliant and Caicedo have done brilliant Brighton, but he's gone for 100 and odd million. If Brighton had got relegated, what price would a Caicedo been?
I think you're right though, Tony, because Matt, if you think back to Leicester's performances, a lot of it was about, the players have given up. And he was part of that. And I think in a few post-match interviews, he admitted that their attitude wasn't right. So if you've got historic doubts about his personality, and then you've got a season in which it's partly a player attitude, not just him, but collectively, but he's part of that as one of the more talented players, you think, maybe there's a doubt there. And the reason I think Spurs got him was that it feels like fate. He always knew he was going to play for Spurs one day. He modelled himself on Christian Eriksen when he played for Spurs. He feels like a Spurs player. He feels like, you're watching him, it feels like he's come through the academy.
Mm. It feels like a match made in heaven as well with Ange Postecoglou, because I don't know, if he'd have gone to United or he'd gone to Chelsea, I don't think we'd have seen these performances.
Yeah.
No. And I loved, he did one interview where he said about the conversation that he had with Postecoglou on the phone. And one of the things that convinced Maddison to go there was that Postecoglou said, "James, if you come or not, we're going to play really well this season." And along that message, and it was like, wow.
We'll go to the South Coast next. And another star performer was young Evan Ferguson, hat-trick hero. He was outstanding. And there seems to be the sort of sense that there's a very, very high ceiling for this kid. He's only 18, 19 next month. Scoring goals at a rate of knots.
Well, you were there, Greg, and you were not surprised, were you?
No, he's got a bit of everything. He has he's got the strength and the power to be a target man. He's got the kind of intelligence, the technique and the movement to link up play, which you have to do in a Roberto De Zerbi's Brighton team. And he's got the pace to stretch defences. He's got a bit of everything. So, you know, there's some quite outlandish comparisons being drawn since this. You know, it's just probably, we all knew he was outstanding last season, but this is the clearest evidence yet that he's a star. And, you know, Gary Lineker drew a parallel with Erling Haaland. But he has got that kind of physicality that makes you kind of, your eyes widen a little bit. And it was an outstanding performance. And Roberto De Zerbi said that he thinks he can be one of the top goal scorers in Europe.
Right.
Is this too much? Too young for a 18-year-old? He doesn't look like he's going to be faced by it.
No, if you see his interviews,
yeah,
he's really feet on the ground.
Absolutely.
And loves playing football. Yeah. Look, he's a public violence striker, and I've had loads of conversations about, you know, Evan, and what type of player he is. And you're right, it's hard to, because he has got a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And he's probably 7 or 8 in most departments. He's not 6 in any of them, because he can, you know, I think he's, in some strange way, he's heading. It's still, you know, expect him to improve on his heading ability as well. And he's fearless. He seems to have a swagger about him. And, I mean, look, Brighton are a side that, if you're a centre-forward, it's a bit of a dream. Matamo going down one side, and then, you know, I mean, it's interesting, because we were talking about players and clubs and move, and Gilmore's gone to Brighton, and he's playing really well.
Gilmore was fascinating to watch.
And, you know, he's a really good player, Gilmore. But, you know, I was lucky enough to be at the Euro game against Scotland, where Gilmore held his own. He was comfortable in the game. And then watch him go to Norwich and struggle. And then he goes to Brighton. Oh, and by the way, another Brighton player starts and shines and shows what he's capable of. Because I think, again, it's all about when you walk into a team that complement you and improve your game, because he does bring the team into play. Solly Marsh, you know, Solly Marsh is, again, another really good player. His numbers are up. Everybody's numbers are up at Brighton.
Yeah.
And he will. And the thing that excites me is that you're going to see Ferguson play a lot of games this season. He's not going to be a bit part player like he was, because yes, last year he was coming to the fold and showing what he can do. They were really impressed. They got him. What did they do, Brian? Got him on a 5-year deal immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately. There weren't even a conversation of, oh, others might be looking. Straight away, Brighton, 5-year deal. They know what they've got. And I think that in itself, I'm really looking forward to seeing how this season pans out for him.
How many people around this table thought, oh, that defeat to West Ham, maybe Brighton, oh, it's going to be a difficult season with Europe and everything? Because of what they did last season, any blip, they completely
blew away.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That to me was exactly the performance I was expecting, even against a strong Newcastle side, that they would not let. There's something about, I don't know if it's De Zerbi particularly, but there's something about the way they do not dwell on any setbacks
whatsoever.
Well, it's
what the you same thing. About Postecoglou.
No, yeah, I was just going to say, Tony, it's the same clarity and conviction in what they're doing. Like the start of this game, Newcastle started really well. They pressed them really, like, ferociously. They forced a couple of errors. Isaac could have scored twice. Almiron could have scored. But they kept doing it. They kept trying to build from the back and, you know, almost bait the press. You know, you see the centre-halves standing on the ball and around the halfway line, waiting for someone to draw in to create some space, try and find a little pocket of space for Billy Gilmore to get on the half-turn. And he just kept doing it and kept doing it. And by then, you know, midway through the second half, Newcastle were just pulled from pillar to post, and it was a dominant one.
Did anyone ask about goalkeeping? Because he's done it again, De Zerbi. So he makes these strange mid-season, or any. I mean, Jason Steele was his golden boy, but he's relegated to the bench suddenly, because he is ruthless about, if he sees mistakes, he doesn't do the whole, well, a goalkeeper's confidence needs building. It's like,
it's to do with the ball at the feet again. I mean, I know Jason Steele's very good with the ball at his feet, but I think he's even better. There were a few in the first half where he tried to play it to the fullback and they were cut out, but he is very good on the ball, and it's like he's like another man in the build up phase.
Did he miss out on Onana then, did he?
Maybe. Yeah.
We've had quite a few Brighton lovings down the last couple of years, and it's before De Zerbi came in, and it's the platform of that club.
It's everything.
Exactly. It's all over. But what I love about De Zerbi is that every time a player has a real outstanding performances, the natural move from managers tends to be to try and temper that excitement. He does the opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, with Mudrick, he was saying, and this was a player who'd gone, but he said he can win the Ballon d'Or. There aren't many higher individual. There's no individual prize that a player can win bigger than that. With Solly March this season, he said he can get, was it 15 goals, he said? A guy who's playing left back a few.
When you look at Solly March's numbers over the previous year, and I mean, he got goals last season, but the years before, it's like 3 in 5 years or something. And just amazing.
And then, as you pointed out, Gregor, this with Evan Ferguson, top goal scorer in Europe, that's quite a target to set. And it's funny because I think we all had that similar feeling with watching him, because it is still quite early in his development. And I remember in January, I spent a bit of time at Oxford United, and they were looking to get him on loan and thought it was going to happen. And then he comes into the first team for, I think it was a cup game, and scores a couple of goals, and he's never, there's no chance he's leaving. So he's gone from potentially League One to now being told he's going to be could be top goal scorer in Europe. But we watch him, and there was this, you know, when Gary Lineker said about him being like Erling Haaland, you kind of thought, well, that does feel a bit big, bit ambitious, but at the same time, you watched it and thought, you're trying to stop yourself from having those thoughts.
It's to do with his physicality. It's so jarring for someone so young.
But
and
do you think
Haaland was the same?
Do you think it's also because he's this young guy from County Meath in Ireland that also kind of stops us from thinking that there is that potential there, like stupidly, but he's not this exotic player from abroad.
That's a fair point. Yeah. And De Zerbi can even bought into the, you know, he's obviously asked about, because there's been so many players who've been sold for multi-millions. He just said that the problem is not when we sell them, it's that we always find someone to replace them. And so he's totally bought into the kind of the whole ethos of the club. So the question is, what's Brighton's ceiling? Obviously, they've got a great draw in the Europa League as well. They've got trips to Ajax, Marseille, AEK Athens. They've just signed on loan a former team prodigy from Barcelona and Ansu Fati. It's a great week for the club. What's their ceiling?
Can I'm more excited about their Europa League
brilliant draw, isn't it?
Journey than anyone at the first stage of the Champions League, to be quite honest. It's a really glamorous group, and they'll be, I just very interested in what their opponents make of them, because there is this thing in Europe that if you haven't got any pedigree, they tend to treat you like dirt. But they'll be foolish if they do that. And will Brighton just play like they all... Will they alter for Europe, or will they just go out and try and blitz them? Probably the latter,
absolutely,
I expect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that it will be a shock to the system for some elite clubs in Europe. It's a great history. They will find themselves thinking, oh, we're only playing Brighton. Who are they? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I did a piece for La Provençale in Marseille about 7-8 years ago. And I had a go at Marseille about their style of play. I said, Marseille have got on their badge, droit à but, which is right to goal, straight to goal. Okay? That's on their badge. That's their idea. They go after everybody. And Marseille kept playing counter-attacking football. And I don't like to mention, but a very Graham Potter type of way, which isn't suited to me for a big club. And I think Spurs have shown that. And I think you obviously saw that with Potter's Chelsea. And so I've always sort of said, that's their style, okay? That's what Marseille should be. And then they've got them in the cup, and I think in Europe, and I think, well, you're playing the team that should have that on their badge. That should be their badge, because that's exactly how Brighton play. They come after you from everywhere, and it's done with wing-backs, full-backs. You know, I see people like Veltman, who's been there forever, 800 grand, and I've watched him for Ajax, and... You know, and done a great servant to the
Pascal
club.
Gross got his first Germany call up this week as well.
Exactly.
Lewis Dunk called up for England.
But to a man, you could nearly go for every player in their team.
Yeah.
And that's without the ones they've sold. And I look at them and I think, I want Marseille to play like them.
I think every team in the league watches Brighton now and says, I want my team to play like that.
Yeah.
They're the best value ticket in the country.
The thing that will be interesting is if a big club decides to part way with a manager this season, because I think anyone would look at De Zerbi and think he improves players, because you mentioned Billy Gilmour earlier. He didn't have a good season there last year.
No.
Struggled to play too much, and I worried a little bit for him, because with McAllister and Caicedo going, they are massive boots to fill. And he's had a brilliant start to the season.
He was on him in the first half, De Zerbi. He was, about turning, opening up his body under pressure, but he thinks he can do that. And it's about, you know, breaking the lines quickly. But Gilmore, I think, you know, were it not for Ferguson's hat-trick, yeah, he probably would have been man of the match. Mm-hmm. So, great start for Brighton.
But isn't it a wonderful contrast between the two clubs? Because Newcastle are also back in Europe and, oh, they're in the Champions League. And yet, I feel less excited about how they're going to do than how Brighton are going to do. It just feels like a fait accompli to me that it's going to be really tough for Newcastle.
Yeah. It's a great draw, though, still. I mean, the pedigree and the kind of... pedigree, the right word for PSG? Anyway, you know, Paris Saint-Germain, Borussia Dortmund and Milan, it's a great draw for Newcastle still, and it's obviously that's the third defeat in a row. It's not crisis point yet, but there's obviously, you know, they've got 2 weeks now to stew on a 3-point haul from their opening four games, so it's not been the it can't go on much longer. You know,
unfortunately,
this kind of stuttering
PSG
start.
Have sort of found their way again a little bit, and Mbappe settled his differences with the club, and they won at Lyon last night 4-1, and they're a little bit better than where they were. I think the PSG of last season won't be that side. They'll be slightly better this year. But Newcastle got a massive challenge in that group.
Yeah, but Newcastle, I mean, it's not crisis point, is it?
No.
No. Well, it's a test of the people that run that club now, of how they, if this continues, of how they respond to it, because I think that was always going to be the problem with achieving top four last season, even though it was way beyond the progress most people expected, and it set a bar for Newcastle now, because you are now a top four club. The Champions League is what is expected. It was always the goal. You just got there a little bit quicker than anticipated.
But if
now
they are
there,
humiliated in the Champions League, will Eddie Howe get the sack?
We're a long way. Lots of ifs and buts.
Yeah, lots of. I can just say one thing, and it would have been interesting, because I like the boy Botman, who was obviously injured.
Huge loss.
And that, I would have loved to have seen him up against Ferguson, because he revels in that one-on-one battle. And I think,
but it's not just his absence from Newcastle, it's what it does to the team. Dan Burn has to come in.
Yeah, come inside.
Matty Target has to go left back. And then you could see even the relationship with him and with Burn and Shar was nowhere near the same. And then the relationship with Bruno in front of them, Brighton just had so much space in front of their back four. So it's quite, you know, the equilibrium is quite fragile for Newcastle. But they've got a lot of challenges this season, and they're going to have to. That's the one area of their team where you think the quality, the step down is huge.
One question, Greg, because I don't know how he finds a way of doing this, Eddie Howe, but I was at the Brentford game last year when Newcastle won the game, and first half they played Isak on his own up front. The moment in the second half they went with Isak and Callum Wilson, the team seemed to shine way more. I just think Isak is a little bit lightweight. Although he's a very gifted footballer, he needs someone alongside him with a bit of a presence. And Callum Wilson does give you that.
Isak, I think he led the line well, in the first, until Newcastle essentially gifted Brighton in the opener with Nick Pope's kind of double error. And then Callum Wilson just always comes off the bench and makes an impact. He scored the goal, although it was a consolation. So you're right, I mean, it's going to be tempting sometimes to go two up front, but I think the biggest issue for them is at the back. But no crisis point yet from Newcastle, a long way from that. We'll go to Anfield next.
Parting gift from Salah, lovely.
You knew how to broach it, to break the ice, Tom. Come on, guys, there's a week left. Is Salah still going to be there? Is it?
Well, let's just strip it back. Salah doesn't. I mean, he'd get an amazing salary, eye-watering salary, but he doesn't get. You know, the amount of money being offered for him is not under his control or something that he directly benefits from. What Klopp's doing very cleverly, I think, is sort of just letting it percolate that, of course, they want him because he's the best forward there is, and it's flattering to him, but he wants to clearly show his talents with a club that love him in a league that is competitive, and he's, you know, in the middle of a wonderful career, not at the end of it. It's sort of, he's turned what could be something that was very disruptive into a positive, so that you love him more. The crowd don't get on his back. It's not his fault that the Saudi League want him. It's sort of seen as a badge of honour almost that such ridiculous amounts of money are being mentioned, because they, you know, why wouldn't you want him? And I don't. And the, one of the lovely things about the win over a very good Villa team, who I think were off it slightly actually, but generally a good Villa team, was that it didn't feel like it had done anything other than make the unit more cohesive, make them feel more of just more of Liverpool, and that suddenly, why would he want to leave? Because actually, we're playing so well as a group, we could challenge for the title this year, where people have assumed we wouldn't. So it's not been disruptive, and I don't get any sense at all that there's going to be this.
I mean, it has been disruptive.
That there's going to be this last minute hijack.
It has been disruptive because Klopp has to answer questions continuously with it.
Which is why he's been clever about it.
His quotes were interesting, though. I thought he said that he was asked if he had, you know, because I think Szoboszlai said in one interview that he's told us he's staying at Anfield. That may have been, you know, that may have slipped out. Then Klopp was asked the same, and he said he's not had any conversation. So, you know, you kind of wonder to yourself, does he not want to have the conversation because he doesn't want to hear the answer?
Yeah.
Does he not want to give him the opportunity to even make, you know, answer that question because it's not his choice? Mm. It's a funny kind of dynamic that, though, that they've not actually discussed it.
Yeah,
It's clever. Why divert attention away from training? Why do that?
I'm having a little bit of Monday morning fun by teasing Alison with the idea of Salah going, but I genuinely don't know whether he stays or goes, because I just don't think, when you look at the way Saudi have approached business in transfers, they haven't tended to go for anyone they don't think they can get.
That's true.
And I just wonder whether there has been some encouragement on Salah's part that he would be interested in a possible move there, because otherwise why go to such extents and why go to these such wild numbers? And I do wonder whether the way Klopp is speaking is more of a message to FSG than anyone else, because the problem here is that if you're FSG and you're offered £200 million for Salah and you think you take it because
for a 31-year-old, that's another question. That's another question altogether. Well, what, you know, should you really, with any sort of degree of sanity, turn down that kind of money for a 31-year-old?
No, but the reason I was saying that was because the problem is if you accept it, I worry, and I do think that they have brilliant alternative options, not as good as Salah, but they have brilliant alternative options to him. So they're almost preparing for life after Salah at some stage. But if they accept now, I worry about what that does to Jurgen Klopp and the relationship that Jurgen Klopp has, because I don't think Ali's a million miles wrong. I think they could potentially be the challengers to City this season.
Yeah, it's a bit of a selfish choice for a player, isn't it? If you think of what they did to golf and Dustin Johnson leaving the PGA, DeChambeau leaving the PGA as well, Cameron Smith, these are players that commanded at least $200 to $300 million, and they can't, you know, you can't even get a buyback clause on them. There's no buyback on them. You know, so they can go to whatever number they think's possible. That's the danger that Premier League football is facing. You know, we're not going to be in Sydney and go, oh, sadly, they're only going to 160. Liverpool go 170. They go, no.
Yeah, the next one's 50 million.
It's just, you know, I'm hopeful he stays. Some players are irreplaceable. But if you look at what we've talked about, the Brighton model, and Brentford have done it, that you can move on players and there's always someone to step into their shoes. I get that. I just feel that the season started, and for Salah, you know, I was asked that question, what would I do? And I say, I wouldn't want to leave the standard of football I'm playing.
Exactly.
You know, I got offered China and Switzerland at the very end of my career. And I thought, do I want to go to the Swiss League? Now, league in France is better than the Swiss League, but there isn't a massive gulf. There are leading clubs in France, but I didn't. And then when China came out, I was like, whatever I'd done in China didn't matter. It was only purely going to be about a move of money. And it wasn't the sums of money that we're even close to thinking about. And I remember thinking that at the time, I just didn't want to go and play in a league that I didn't think was competitive and would it excite me. Now, it's always a tough one, because you're putting that, like I said, that Sophie's choice of the mind-boggling money. It's not like I was at Marseille and I'm getting, I don't know, oh, sorry, I was at Nancy when I got the China option, and I was getting like £6,000 a week, which is still a lot of money today, and they're offering me 10. Okay, so yeah, it's better, but you know, it was. But when you're being offered, I don't know, you're being paid £300,000 a week, and someone says to you, we'll give you £1.7 million net. It's one of them. Unless you're being, it's put to you, you might not even know how you're going to react to it.
But he could get that money when he's a bit older.
Of course, yes.
He doesn't have to do it now.
No.
That money will be available to him when he's a bit older.
The standard would bother me. I would be thinking about, I'm playing the Premier League, one of the best leagues around, Champions League football, the Ballon d'Or and everything that goes with it. And by the way, Salah would earn a fortune off, you know, via social media, and, you know, just Salah's brand is worth a huge fortune anyway. I couldn't do it.
Some interesting comments from Gareth Southgate about this as well, which we'll speak about on Thursday, in reference to Jordan Henderson, of course, who's gone out to Saudi Arabia. Just one last point on the game. Obviously Salah was a big story in this, and he scored the third. I think Paul Joyce wrote today that it's the 150th game he scored in 309 Liverpool appearances. So yeah, we cannot underestimate how important a player this is for Liverpool. But Szoboszlai already looks like a star.
He's very young.
22.
Well, he's going to be 23 next month, but he talks.
You're going to get him a birthday card.
But I was sort of shocked to be reminded of his age, because he talks like he's 32. He plays like he's 32, but he's got the fitness and aggression and dynamism of a 22-year-old. Wow, what a combination. And he's got match intelligence. He's played hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games. I don't know where he's started. He's captain of Hungary, isn't he? Yeah. I mean, this is madness. And I think, to a degree, his signing was slightly under the radar, just ever so slightly, because, I don't know, maybe because people just didn't, just didn't see enough of him to know how he would slot in. But he slotted in so, so quickly. And there's just something about his calmness and...
Snow again.
Let's call him Snow or Sleet or something. But the speed at which he has assimilated into that club is so impressive. He will be. I think he's going to be one of those fan favourites.
Do you like him more than Steve Highway? For our younger listeners, you might remember, because I know how much you love Steve Highway from the late 70s.
There'll never be anyone as wonderful as Stevie Highway. Well, Stevie Highway is the reason I'm sat here talking to you about football. He made me fall in love with football. He was a ballerina on grass.
Right. I think that's about all we've got time for. There's so many good games this weekend too. I think it was one of those where no one deserved to be last on Match of the Day. Some great, great games
and
elsewhere.
And yet we put Liverpool last on the podcast.
Well,
strange.
That was my choice today.
No.
Anyway, we'll be back on Thursday to talk about international football. Tom Roddy, Tony Cascarino and Alison Rudd, thank you very much for joining me. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you're subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll be back on Thursday.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.